offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, as always coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. And it's, as always, a wonderful feeling to join all of you. And as I've mentioned many, many times before, and I don't think I'm going to be tired of mentioning it, on this wonderful opportunity of conversing with all of you and discussing and sharing thoughts on the beautiful work of the Bhagavad Gita. Oftentimes, when you look at it, some of these, what we are going through is quite repetitive in a sense, because much of what I've mentioned this last week must be something I've mentioned before. What I'm going to be speaking today would have been mentioned on different occasions, even in this very program before. But one thing that has to be kept in mind is, when you read certain books, you read them for knowing or to gather knowledge. But there are few other books which are not meant merely for gathering knowledge, but are also for reminding yourself of knowledge. I would often think of it as through this analogy. If you were to buy a very expensive painting, right? If you spend a few lakhs and buy a painting by a very famous artist, you could probably hang it in your wall and, you know, you will admire it for a few days. You will show it to the people who come to you. That is the value of the art, right? It's very beautiful, but there is only a few hundred times that you can look at it. But if you were to spend, say, 1% of that money or even lesser than that and buy a mirror that you hang on the wall, you would probably look at that mirror much more often than you would probably look at a painting for which you've spent many, many lakhs. The reason is, yes, the painting conveys something, right? Every artist tries to convey something through their piece of art. But if you look at a mirror, the mirror changes with you. Every day that you look at the mirror is changing with you, right? And some books, especially like the epics like Ramayana, Mahabharata, the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, the Satisai Speaks, these are like mirrors, right? We do gather knowledge from them, definitely. These are books which are worthy sources of knowledge. But every time we go to these books and read them and reread them, the meaning that they convey will change with our growth, just like how the appearance on the mirror changes as we change, right? And that is why, even as we go through the Bhagavad Gita, let us all keep this in our minds always, that this is not merely to be informed. Yes, that is one of the important aspects of the program. But another very, very important aspect of the program is rumination, is the ability to keep thinking about this again and again. And I think even in this week's episode, there will be a mention of why that is so important, right? Why that mental rumination is such an important aspect of spiritual sadhana. And every opportunity to read, reread, listen, discuss some of these books is an opportunity to ruminate over and over again. So with those few words, probably we'll begin this week's program. As always, let me give you a brief of what we covered last week so that it gives us that idea of continuity. We went through verses 44, 45 and 46 of the second chapter. In verse number 44, you know, Krishna makes the assertion that those whose mind is distracted do not have one-pointedness. This is something which has been reiterated over and over again in the past few verses. And in this particular point in the Bhagavad Gita, the specific reference is to the Vedas or the scriptures. And I also gave you a bit of the background where a lot of people were in those times of the Dwapara age had taken to the ritualistic aspects of the Vedas themselves. And to a certain extent, Krishna was addressing that aspect of the distortion the use of the Vedas had undergone. So he was saying that the yagnas and yagas are performed purely with certain benefits in mind, to achieve something, or it could even be something like a place in heaven, but nevertheless, that is a limited desire which is trying to be acquired through this process of mastering the Vedas. And the verses which we did a couple of weeks ago, there is a reference to flowery words of the Vedas, which means that there are people who tend to speak of the utility of the Vedas in flowery words by saying that it can give you this, it can give you that, it can give you authority, it can give you success, it can give you progeny. And all of those flowery words are the distractions Krishna is referring to here. He says, he not only says that they distract you from one-pointedness towards your goal, he says they steal your mind, right? That's the beautiful word that Krishna uses here. The flowery words which give you the promise of bhoga and aishwarya, or authority. Bhoga means sensual pleasures, and aishwarya means power and authority and wealth. So the flowery words which give you the promise of bhoga and aishwarya literally steal the mind away from its purpose. And the reason why bhoga and aishwarya have the ability to steal the mind away is because they can never be achieved. And that's what we discussed last time. There is no limit to how much power you can have. There is no limit to how much sensual enjoyment that you can have, because by nature, once the object of that sensual pleasure is removed, the experience goes away. So you have to indulge again. And same is the case with power and authority. There's always somebody who is more powerful than you. There's somebody or something that you cannot achieve with the power that you have in your hand. So you always have a desire to achieve more power. So there is no way you can have absolute bhoga and absolute aishwarya. And that is why the goal is the ultimate and you get distracted from it. In verse number 45, Krishna speaks again of the Vedas as being an expression of the three gunas. And I also mentioned that Adi Shankara clearly says that when Krishna says the Vedas are an expression of the three gunas, he is still referring to the flowery interpretation of the Vedas as being that of confined to the three gunas. Because I think that is a safe conclusion to come to, because Krishna himself says that the Vedas are beyond the three gunas. They can give you the ultimate, but we are only seeking that which can be useful only in the worldly realm. So Krishna says that these flowery interpretations of the Vedas make it appear like it is purely referring to the three gunas. But then Krishna tells Arjuna that you have to go beyond the three gunas. He says, Nistraigunya is the word that Krishna uses. In fact, apart from that word, Nistraigunya, Krishna uses a few more words in the form of instructions to Arjuna. Very, very important words. We, of course, went through all of them in detail. I'll probably just mention those words and give you a brief meaning of each one of them. Krishna says, Nirdvandvo Bhava, meaning go beyond the dualities. And we've spoken about the dualities as being happiness and sadness, success and failure, and achievement and disappointment, and whatever is the dualities you can think of. So Krishna tells him, Nirdvandvo Bhava, that is one of the instructions. Then he says, Nitya Sattvastho Bhava. And we spoke about this. Though the instruction or the ultimate command or the ultimate goal is to go beyond the three gunas, Swami has also emphasized this more than on one occasion, where he says that you should go beyond the three gunas, but the path to reach there or the means to get there is through the quality of sattva or goodness, the desire not to be of any hindrance to anybody, not to be the cause for anybody's hurt or harm, right? That is the approach to go beyond the three gunas. So to become a Nistraigunya, Krishna says that you have to be a Nitya Sattvastho, Nitya Sattvastaha. So he says, Nitya Sattvastho Bhava. And then he says, Nir Yoga Kshema Bhava. And we spoke about yoga and kshema being the two luring factors which make us do anything in life. And here at this point, yoga does not mean the yoga which we use to refer to union with God. Because when we talk about Buddhir Yoga, we talk about Karma Yoga, the connotation for yoga is completely different. There's going to be another phrase in the verses which we're going to cover today, which defines yoga a little more differently, right? So that yoga is different. Here, yoga merely means achieving something on which you have, you know, aspired for, right? You have made something your goal. Achieving that is yoga. And once you have achieved it, trying to protect it is kshema, right? And Krishna says that whatever actions each one of us take up, it is purely driven by yoga and kshema. I want to achieve something, and having achieved it, I want to protect it. I want to become rich. Having become rich, I want to remain rich. I want to have children. Having had children, I want to protect and foster those children. So it is all driven by this yoga and kshema. So Krishna tells him, be nir-yoga kshema when you are performing your actions. Don't think about what is that you will achieve or what is it that you're going to protect, but do karma without thinking of any of those things. And then finally he says, atmavan bhava. Atmavan, as we went through, is somebody who is in control of oneself, right? Because Krishna is talking about being distracted by the allurements of bhoga and aishwarya. So once you are distracted, once you have been drawn by other things, you're not in control of yourself, right? Though it might appear that we are achieving what we want, we don't realize that we are made to aspire for a certain achievement because we have been distracted, right? So that's what Krishna says, be an atmavan, be somebody who is in control of himself or herself, saying that this is my goal, this is my purpose, and I wish to progress towards that, not being distracted by anything else. So these are the few words in verse number 45 Krishna uses. He says, Nistraigunyo bhava, Nirdvandvo bhava, Nityasatvastho bhava, Nidyogakshema bhava, and Atmavan bhava. Right? So these are the instructions which Krishna gives Arjuna in that context. Verse number 46 is again a very, very beautiful verse where Krishna gives a wonderful analogy. He says that a person who has attained Brahman, he uses the word Brahminaha, but the reference here is to someone who has attained the goal, right? So one who has attained the goal, he has nothing to do with the bhoga and aishwarya and the flowery promises of the Vedas. And he gives this comparison. He says, all of what the Vedas can promise is to one who has achieved the Brahman. For him, it is like the need one has for a pond or a well when there is a flood of water all around. Right? It's a very beautiful analogy. He says, when there is a flood of water around, water is so accessible, you are not going to go in search of water or go in search of a source of water like a pond or a well. Right? The reason why this analogy is very profound and very deep is that when you talk about the pleasure that comes out of achievement, the pleasure that comes out of worldly possessions, bhoga and aishwarya, these are nothing but means through which we are finding that bliss which is truly ours within, right? These are nothing but means by which this bliss which is within, which is eternal, is being rationed to us in small quantities and only making us crave more. But if you have found a way by which you can dip into this eternal source of bliss, then you will not need any of these small pipelines and you know, which make you crave for it and which make you depend on them, right? And that is why this is very beautiful. And the other point which I mentioned last week repeatedly, which I'll tell again, is though the reference here is to yoga, I'm sorry, the reference here is to the Vedas and the interpretation of the Vedas, this can be applied to life itself. Whatever Krishna is telling about the Vedas, he is saying that the Vedas can give you the ultimate, they can also give you worldly achievements and worldly benefits, but it's about what you ask from it. Same is the case with life itself. Swami says that, you know, the human birth is so precious that you can achieve oneness with divine in the process of this human birth. But the same human birth can be used to achieve worldly achievements and worldly wealth too, right? So it is about what we choose to do with that. So whatever Krishna has been telling about the Vedas, the flowery interpretation of the Vedas, the distractions of those interpretations of the Vedas can be applied to life in general itself, and of course can be applied to any scripture which is a spiritual text which is there to lead us to the ultimate. So these are the verses that we went through, 44, 45 and 46. We will go to verse number 47, very, very important verse. I think the moment you listen to the verse itself, you will know why this is an important verse and what is so special about this verse. But we'll first listen to it. I'll give you a brief meaning after that, and then we'll discuss in detail about it. This verse again is rendered very beautifully and clearly by Brother Shyam. And I think whoever sends me emails in appreciation of this program always mention that they're very, very thankful to Brother Shyam for his wonderful and clear rendition of the Bhagavad Gita shlokas. And I join you all in expressing my gratitude to Brother Shyam for this. We'll listen to the verse number 47 of chapter 2 and then we'll proceed from there.
Karmanyevadhikaraste ma phaleshu kadachana ma karma phalahetubhuhu ma te sangostva karmani.
You have a right to perform your prescribed duty, but you are not entitled to the fruits of action. Never consider yourself to be the cause of the results of your activities, and never be attached to not doing your duty. The translation that I just read is a very general explanation, a general translation that is always given, and I am saying that I know very well that whatever I read out is probably not the best interpretation, as we will see when we discuss it. And the other point about verse number 47 itself is, as I said, it's a very, very important verse. One, because of the contents. The other is, of course, because of the contents, Swami has quoted it many, many times. I mentioned that verse number 38, that Sukadukhe Same Kritva, is one of the most quoted verses from the Bhagavad Gita by Swami, and something which gives its very stiff competition must be verse number 47 that we just heard, because so many times Swami has quoted this. In fact, many, many people quote this as the essence of the Bhagavad Gita itself. That if someone were to ask what is the basic or the most fundamental message of the Bhagavad Gita, people would probably say Karmanyevadhikaraste, right? This is the verse which would be often referred to in that case. This is, as I said, the meaning which I read out for this particular verse is probably not the best way of looking at it, right? We will come to that eventually when we start defining word by word, and I think that's, we'll start that right away. Krishna says, Karmani, which means on action, eva, alone, adhikaraha. Karmani, on action, eva adhikaraha te. On action alone, you have right or authority, adhikaraha. Ma phaleshu, not in the results, kadachana, at any point of time. So Krishna says, to understand this, and act all the time, or indulge in activity, is what Karma Yoga is all about. That one has control and can exercise choice only over the actions that one does, but one does not have any authority over the results. Right? And that is why this is very, very important, because still this point Krishna has not defined Karma Yoga really. He's only been telling the benefits of Karma Yoga. Here he starts defining what Karma Yoga is. He says, Karmani eva adhikarahate ma phaleshu kadachana. You have authority only over the actions, and you do not have any authority over the fruits of those actions. And to constantly remember this is what Karma Yoga is all about, because as Krishna said, I'm going to teach you Buddhir Yoga. The yoga which I'm going to teach you is not physical, right? It is not asana. It is not something which you do with your body. It is a Buddhir Yoga, which means it has something to do with your thinking, something to do with the way you approach the activity. So to constantly remember this is all Karma Yoga is about. And probably this is where Swami corrects this understanding when you say that you do not have authority over the results. As I read out the meaning, it is often translated as you do not have the right over the results. But Swami corrects this understanding. But for that, I think I will read out whatever Swami has written himself. But you know, even before we come to that, when Krishna says you do not have authority over the results, what does it really mean? I think in one of the verses that we went through, we did go through this a few times, that for every result that occurs for an action that we have performed, there are many, many variables that the result depends on. Let's say I'm a teacher. If all the results of my actions were to depend on me, as a teacher, I'm taking classes for my students, probably conceivable, or I think it's fair enough to say that the result is how the children fare in the exam, right? Let's just say that I'm putting effort as a teacher and the way that the students fare in the exam is the result. If the result completely depends on me, wouldn't it happen that all the students will get the same grade when the exams come through? If the result completely depends on me, the very fact that, you know, different children do differently and some fail, some pass, some come out with flying colors, it means that, yes, this is the result of my activity as a teacher, but this result does not entirely depend on me, right? And that is the essence of Krishna saying that the results do not, you do not have authority over the results. Same is the case with even parenting, you know, as a mother and father, you might bring up 2-3 children. Not all of them turn out with the same personality. Each one has a personality of their own. That's because most of the activities that we do, the results are always based on multiple factors, and we certainly do not have control over all those factors that are involved. One of the many factors that are involved is our actions, and that is the only factor that we have control over. So what Krishna is stating here is not an imaginary philosophy, and that's the beauty of it. It is very, very pragmatic. Only thing Krishna is saying is to internalize this and constantly remember that whatever I might do, I might put my 100%, I might even put my 200% into what I'm doing, but still the result does not entirely depend on my effort. Just to have this very, very simple, I think it's very commonsensical, right? To remember this is all Karma Yoga is all about. And this fact has to be remembered before taking up an action, while performing an action, and after having completed the action, and when we are waiting for results or when you're waiting for the consequences of what we've done, right? And this attitude in these various phases of doing an action, before, during and after, has different manifestations and it expresses in different ways. We will be coming to that in the verses that follow. But for now, let us just remember this, that to remember all the time that our results are not purely based on our actions. Yes, our actions are important, but they are not all important. Now, coming to what Swami adds to this, and in fact, Swami adds another very important dimension that literally completes the understanding of this particular verse. Now, we interpreted the word adhikaraha as authority or control, right? But the word adhikaraha can also be interpreted as right. I have a right over this, right? Adhikaram can also be interpreted as right. So when we now say, karmani eva adhikaraha te ma faleshu kadachana, it can also be translated as, you have right only over the action that you perform. You have no right over the results thereof. But Swami says very clearly, you have done the action. No one can take away the right that you have over the results of the actions that you have performed. Let's say I have worked very, very hard and I have written my exam and I have written it really well. I have the right over getting good grades in that exam, right? Though there are factors which can distort the result, I certainly have right over good results in that sense. I come every day and I work sincerely and I perform all the tasks that have been assigned to me, and I'm delivering as an employee of the organization. I certainly have right over the salary that I'm drawing at the end of the month, right? That's what Swami says. Nobody can take away the right that you have over the results of some of your actions. But Swami says, you must consciously sacrifice it, saying, I am not interested in it. I am not going to focus on it. I'm going to focus only on the actions that I'm performing and not on the benefits that I accrue thereof. Right? And that is why Swami uses the word, or Swami uses the phrase, he says, karma phala tyaga. Right? He says, karma phala tyaga. Tyaga means sacrifice. And you cannot sacrifice something which is not yours. I cannot pick up your money and do a sacrifice out of that. Right? Sacrifice is always what is rightfully mine, I give away, right? So Swami says, karma phala tyaga. And that is why this interpretation of Swami is very, very important. And I'll probably read out those couple of paragraphs from the Gita Vahini where Swami explains this very categorically and very, very succinctly. Swami says, and I quote, "On this point, many commentators have exercised their intelligence and written differently. Many have said that the giving up of fruit is advised because there is no right or authority for the doer to desire the fruit. This is a great blunder. The Lord has said in the Gita, refuse the fruit, ma phaleshu. That is to say, the deed yields results, but the doer should not desire the results or do it with the result in view. If Krishna's intention was to say that the doer has no right to the fruit, he would have said it is fruitless, na phaleshu, na meaning no. When one has a right to engage in action or karma, one has a right also to the fruit. Nobody can deny this or refuse this right. But doers can, out of their own free will and determination, refuse to be affected by the result, whether favorable or unfavorable. The Gita shows the way. Do, it says, but don't be attached to the consequences." End of quote. Swami says so clearly that you must sacrifice or do tyaga of the fruits. And what does this sacrificing of the fruits practically mean, right? You know, when you say that karma phala tyaga, what does this practically mean? I mean, how do I follow it in everyday life? And Swami very, very beautifully says in that quote, not being affected by the consequences is what karma phala tyaga means. And this is the most important point in this particular verse. When we all start practicing this karma phala tyaga, how do I know that whether I'm doing it right, whether I'm doing it in a manner that it has to be done? We will not be affected by the consequences. So there are two important messages that probably I would take from this sentence. One, you do not have complete control over the results, but you have complete control and authority over the actions that you perform. So keep that always in mind. And this becomes a very, very practical way by which the mind can be trained not to be too bothered about the consequences too much. And the second point that you have to keep in mind is exercise your right when it comes to your actions, but the results have to be consciously let go of. And the implications of this will be very, very beautifully explained in the verses to follow. Though Swami has given us a small hint of what it is by saying that you will not be affected by the consequences which are positive or negative. So when we constantly keep the first point in mind, that the results are based on so many, many factors, it would not make us feel that I cannot claim I am the sole reason for the results, right? I will not have the authority to say that I have done and that is why these results have come. Take an example of a farmer, right? And we always keep going back to that example. The farmer and his family does everything right, right? He's supposed to, whatever is the process of farming which is involved, preparing the field and buying the right kinds of seeds and then irrigating the farm and all of that. Everything he does perfectly well, right? And it's over a few months that he does this. But if the rain does not come on time, 100% effort goes down the drain, isn't it? Right? He has done everything in his control perfectly, but still it does not result in the right kind of result. But the same farmer does all of this properly and the rains come in time and then there is a harvest. It would not be right for the farmer to say that the harvest that I've got is entirely based on the effort that I've put in, right? Because if all your effort is there and there's no rain, you don't see the benefit of your actions, right? So when you keep this in mind, when you say that whatever is the result, you know, today I am probably sitting here and speaking on the radio, or today you're able to listen to what I'm speaking and you're able to make sense of it, the sense that you understand the language or you understand a certain amount of the spiritual discourse that we are participating in. The reason that we are able to do this at this moment is based on so many things which were beyond our control, right? The teachers were given us the right input, our parents were given us the right input, the friends that we have met along the way, the life experiences that we have had, yes, we might have sat in a school for 12 years and studied English or studied Sanskrit or whatever it is, but there are so many factors which were beyond our control which have contributed to us being here, right? So when we constantly keep remembering that, we will realize that our authority over the actions will start in our mind, right? That's the most important thing. In our mind, we will start seeing that, we will start automatically saying that, yeah, I've got this result, but I cannot claim complete authority over it. And that's why in the next line of this particular verse, Krishna says, Ma bhuhu, don't be or don't consider karma phala hetuhu, yourself as the cause for the karma phalas. In fact, this is why karma, if you look at it, karma yoga is so very empowering, because it is all about you training your mind, right? That's why Krishna says it's a buddhi yoga. It's all in the mind. Till now we are thinking in a certain manner, and the whole approach is to change that thinking. So Krishna says that you have to stop considering yourself as the karma phala hetu, the one who is rightfully the cause for that particular result that has occurred. But the problem is, as we've discussed a few times already, right now, I mean, you and I, and I think I can at least comfortably speak about myself, we are in a state where every action that we do is driven by some result or the other, right? We are constantly thinking of some result or the other. I don't think it's fair enough to say that we are doing it, or we can start doing things without worrying about the results at all. We are in a state where we have some target in mind, we have some results in mind, and then we are doing it. What are the results that we have? As we have mentioned many times before, to get what I like and to avoid what I don't like. Raga and Dvesha. We keep coming back to these two words because these are the most important words when you're trying to understand what Krishna is teaching here. So when Krishna says, give up the karma phala, one may quickly probably come up with this brilliant idea that let me give up actions completely, right? Why do the actions and give up the karma phala? If I say that I'm not interested in the karma phala, I might as well stop doing the action itself, right? That seems like the most simplest thing to do. Or if not give up actions completely, at least stop or reduce the actions that we perform, saying that, you know, I want this or I want to achieve that, right? Honestly speaking, that's actually a good idea, right? You kind of concentrate your focus on a few important things rather than spreading yourself thin. It is a good idea, but Krishna very, very clearly gives a caution in this verse itself. He says, Ma astu te sangaha, let your attachment not to be. Ma astu, let not te sangaha, your attachment be to akarmani, to inaction. So Krishna says, don't be attached to the results, but also don't be attached to inaction. In other words, inaction, when there is meant to be action, is also a very, very dangerous thing. We have gone through this earlier too, right? After Krishna explains to Arjuna why he should positively take part in the battle, Krishna says that he explains how participating in the battle is Arjuna's swadharma. And Krishna says that if you do not perform what is your swadharma, that will lead you to sin. Swadharmam hitva papam avapyasi, he says. That when it is your swadharma, at this point inaction becomes a sin. So now the whole task is to find the right motivation for our actions, right? If we have our eyes fixed on the ultimate knowledge, as Krishna has been telling in the past few verses, we can do that to an extent. If we become a mumukshu, if we are constantly thinking about the ultimate deliverance, then automatically the lesser things and lesser distractions will not bother us as much. But there is another way by which we can find a different motivation for our actions. But of course that is going to come a little later, probably in this verse and in the later chapters too. But this is the most important aspect of this particular verse. And it's all about training the mind. And as you can see, it's so very practical and pragmatic to constantly remind ourselves that, you know, whatever results I've seen in my life, yes, I've performed action. Yes, I've aspired for it and I've worked for it. But if I've got it, I cannot say that it has come to me purely because of my efforts. And this thinking is what will allow us to be in the state of mind to perform Karma Yoga. In the next verse, Krishna is going to explain this even further, and I think we'll get a better idea when we go through that verse. We'll listen to verse number 48, and I'll give you a brief meaning after that, and we'll discuss about that.
Yogastah kuru karmani sangam tyakva dhananjaya siddhya siddhyo samo bhutva samatvam yoga uchyate.
By being established in yoga, O Dhananjaya, undertake actions, casting off attachment and remaining equipoised in success and failure. Equanimity is called yoga. Again, another very, very beautiful verse. In the first line, Krishna says, yogastaha, a wonderful word. He says, yogastaha, being firmly established in yoga. That's the meaning of the word, yogastaha, being firmly established in yoga, sangam tyaktva, giving up attachment, kuru karmani, go about performing your actions. He says, yogastaha, being firmly established in yoga, sangam tyaktva, giving up attachment, kuru karmani, go about doing or performing your actions. The idea is that you have to perform actions, right? That's one thing which Krishna has been telling. There is no way you can escape from doing actions. Each one of us have to perform actions. So kuru karmani in that sense is not up for argument. Everybody has to do actions, right? But how should we do it? Krishna explains, being firmly established in yoga and by giving up all attachments. So what is it to be firmly attached in yoga? That Krishna explains in the next line of that same verse. He says, siddhi asiddhayoho samubhutva. To be in equipoise, whether what one wants to happen happens or does not happen. Siddhi asiddhayoho, which means I want it to happen, siddhi, it does not happen, asiddhayoho. To consider both of these, samobhutva, to be equanimous whether this happens or that. So siddhi asiddhayoho samobhutva, and such equanimity, such samatvam, he says such equanimity is called yoga. Samatvam yoga uchyate. Now this idea of samatvam has been repeated so many times already, and I think one of the past couple of weeks I spoke extensively about the value of samatvam and how every path speaks of the importance of the quality of equanimity, right? So it's very, very clear that this is certainly an important quality, but how do we develop that, right? I would often wonder, is it a quality that can be developed? Because sometimes it appears like it's a quality one is born with, right? If you look at some people, they're very, very calm and composed and equipoised. Whereas there are some people who are more passionate and, you know, who get very, very aggressive in what they want to achieve, and they get very disturbed and hurt if they don't achieve what they want. So can it really be developed over a period of time? In fact, Krishna is going to explain how that is possible. So he says, sangam tyaktva. Give up attachment. Attachment to what? We will see that too. Then he says, I mentioned that word, yogastaha, to be established in yoga. And that yoga, of course, Krishna is defined or explained as samatvam is yoga. So who is a yogi? When Krishna says yogastaha, be established in yoga, yeah, which is another way of saying become a yogi, right? So who is a yogi? The one for whom everything is the same. A nirdvandva, right? For whom the dualities do not appear as dualities. In other words, sukha and dukha, jaya and ajaya, profit and loss, comfort and inconvenience, all of these are same for a yogi. All of us have to become a yogi. I think that is the bottom line of this. So at some point, we all have to become a yogi, Because samatvam is the quality of a yogi, and that yogic samatvam is something which all of us have to achieve. Even if you say, no, no, but I am a devotee of Swami and I'm in the bhakti marga, you have no escape. You also have to be a yogi at some point in time. So the question comes to, how do we practically develop this yogic samatvam? Is it something that I can strive for and achieve? The very fact that, you know, we are laboring for something means that we want it, right? How can I labor for something without wanting it, right? That's something which always is a question which comes up. How do you practically follow this when Krishna says, don't bother about the results and do only your actions? How is it ever going to be done practically, and how are we going to develop that attitude? And that's what Krishna says in the second line. He says, siddhi asiddhayoho samubhutva. To be in equipoise, whether what you want happens or not. You're just rephrasing it, you might say, you know, it doesn't make it any easier or any more practical. But let's see if we can understand this in our day-to-day life. And in fact, I'll try and explain it in a certain manner, and I think most of you will be able to relate to it in the sense that all of us are doing this to a certain extent. We only have to make a conscious note of that and add it to our thinking, right? That is the most important thing. I'm repeating that again. What Krishna is teaching is a buddhir yoga, which means a practice which has all got to do with perspective and the mind, right? So this is something that the equanimity which Krishna is talking about, you know, siddhi asiddhayo samo bhutva, is something that we do practice to a certain extent. We just have to keep it in our mind and make it a part of our thinking every time we take up an action. Let's see how we can explain that. Firstly, Krishna says, karmani adhikarahate. You have authority over the action that you perform, which means what action to do is a choice that has been left to you. Well, of course, when I say that it's a choice completely left to you, we have to remember two unspoken points here all the time. One, what you choose must be within the bounds of righteousness and morality. There's no doubt about that. You can't say that, oh, Krishna has given me adhikaram over my choice of action, so I can choose to do an action which is immoral. No, that is totally out of the equation, because it's an unsaid thing that when Krishna is talking about karma yoga, karma automatically means good karma, right? So I'm just re-emphasizing that point again. And secondly, inaction is an option, but only sometimes, right? You can choose to be inactive, but not all the time. Especially when it is your swadharma to act, at that time inaction is not permitted. So if we were to keep these two in mind, the right to choose what you want to do is always there. So when these two are taken care of, you can choose what actions to do. What do we mean by this, that you can choose what actions you want to do? Let's take the example of a career choice, as simple as that. You have the freedom to choose whether you want to be a scientist or you want to be a businessman, let's say. And invariably, this choice will be based on some kind of personal preference, isn't it? Or even if you talk about somebody who's in a job and who wants to begin a startup or wants to set up a shop of their own or whatever it is. Every change that we make or every choice like this we make is based on a certain preference which is inbuilt in us. You know, for example, I might like a 9-to-5 job where I have to do other things in the rest of the day. I would rather like to do and dedicate it to my hobbies and passions. But there are some other people who like the idea of running a business where they have complete control over all the processes, right? So people are different in that sense. Or for example, I might like numbers. Someone might like biology. So based on such personal likes, we make our choices. Nothing wrong in that at all. And these choices will then start defining our karmas. If I want to be a sportsman, I should start spending more time in the ground, right? It makes sense in that sense. If I want to be a scientist, I must take the science stream in school. And that's what I mean by saying that our choices of our ambitions start defining the smaller choices that we make as we go through life. So we make choices based on our likes and dislikes, is what I'm trying to say. And that choice starts defining our karma. Now, as we keep going like this and growing up, a certain ambition will begin to crystallize in life. It could be a short-term ambition, it could be a long-term ambition. Something like, I should get admission into the IIT or IIM, or I should get a doctoral position in a state university, or I should go into an Ivy League school. Whatever it is, you can think of that. I'm giving these examples because these are typically something which we get obsessed with when we are studying in school, that I want to get into this college and I want to get into this course or whatever it is. And once we are obsessed with some idea like that, or obsessed might not be the right word at this point in time because that gives a negative connotation. Once we have set an ambition, let's say, and then we start working towards this, when so much of our karma and hours of what we do, we start putting into the achievement of this goal, whatever we have defined for ourselves. And slowly we start becoming so very attached to that outcome, right? I have to get into this medical school. I have to get into this IIT or whatever is that, right? When we get attached to that event happening, you will either start having nightmares of that event not happening. You know, so many of us will have the nightmare of, oh God, it doesn't happen. Or you will start having sweet dreams of that happening and, you know, you will imagine yourself having graduated from that school or whatever it is. The reason I'm telling this is, let's go back to our topic. In this scenario which I just described to you, how can I become a yogi? Right? That's the whole point we are talking about. Krishna says, Sangam Tyaktva. First of all, give up your obsession. Again, when I say give up your obsession, it does not mean that one day we can wake up and start becoming a yogi. One day we wake up and say, I don't have any ambitions in life and I'm not bothered about happiness and pleasure. It does not happen like that, because if it can be achieved like that, I think all Swami's devotees will be yogis after the first darshan or after the first discourse, right? The very fact that it does not happen, Sangam Tyaktva, is not a one-step process. I think that is something that we have to keep in mind. When Krishna says Sangam Tyaktva, it is not a one-step process. So how do you give up your obsession? You do it slowly. You do it step by step. So give up a little of the attachment that you have to that outcome. And when we say Siddhi Asiddhayoho Samobhutva, how do you give up that attachment? Krishna very beautifully explains in that line, Siddhi Asiddhayoho Samobhutva. Can you make the event of you not getting what you want a little less acceptable to you in your mind? When I want to achieve a certain goal, I get so obsessed with it and so fixed upon that, and that becomes attachment, which means along with that attachment comes this fear of that thing not happening, right? The event of me not getting what I want causes a fear in me. So can we make that fear a little lesser? One is reducing the attachment to what you want, but simultaneously making your mind understand that the adverse of what you want may probably not be such a bad idea. Say I desperately want admission in this college, in this particular course, or I have to get this deal in my business somehow. But I'm able to introduce this thought in my mind, but even if I don't get it, or even if this does not happen, it may not be so bad, right? I'm just introducing that thought in my mind. I want to become a doctor. I'm working very, very hard towards it. What if I don't get it? You just introduce this thought in your mind. So what? It's not the end of life. We still have to, you know, we still have our whole life in front of us, and we could probably do something worthwhile with this life that God has given us, right? There's nothing to worry. So in this way, I am bringing close to each other my response to my dreams materializing and my dreams not materializing. Siddhaha, asiddhaha. It may happen, it may not happen. I am only bringing together my response to these two scenarios which might present itself in my life. So this is, I feel, a very, very practical approach that we all can take up. We all have desires, ambitions, likes and dislikes. They cannot be simply dumped away. But we can slowly train our mind to not react very, very adversely when what we want does not happen. And what does this require? There are a few things which probably I'll come to the end, but I wanted to give a very beautiful example. I think a couple of times before when I'd spoken on this particular topic of being prepared for what you don't like. How do you go about that? I end up giving this example, and the example is that of Dr. Abdul Kalam, the former president of India and one of the most beloved presidents of India, if I could put it that way, a great scientist and more than a great scientist, a wonderful human being, and more than all of that, certainly a great devotee of Swami. When he was a student, you know, when he had just graduated, I'm sorry, when he had just was leaving school, he had only one ambition in his life. He somehow wanted to become a fighter pilot. Not very unimaginable, right? These are some things which people tend to get a fancy for. I want to become a fighter pilot, or I want to become a firefighter. I mean, no offense, these are all great professions. But in our limited life, when we go through school, we have certain professions which we probably start fantasizing about. So in that sense, Abdul Kalam starts seeing that, you know, I want to become this fighter pilot. So he makes, as I said, all his life choices now start aligning to one day him becoming a fighter pilot, right? So he starts preparing for that. After school, he studies aeronautical engineering. Then he joins as a trainee in the Hindustan Aeronautical Limited, HAL, which is in Bangalore even now. So for a few years, he's a trainee there. And finally, he goes for this interview for becoming a fighter pilot. They start recruiting fighter pilots, and he attends that interview in Dehradun, right? So at the same time, he also gets an interview for another very scientific and technical post in the Ministry of Defense itself. And that's in Delhi, so he goes, attends both the interviews. But his mind is on becoming a fighter pilot, right? It's just that because Delhi is so close to Dehradun, he attends that interview probably. But his mind is, I want to be a fighter pilot. And as fate would have it, what happens is he goes for this interview. He comes ninth in that interview and exam which they keep, and they recruit 8 officers, right? So he just misses that opportunity that he's been craving for by a whisker. And he feels so distraught because he has been so passionate about this, and he has come so close and it has been taken away. So he is absolutely devastated. He is depressed. And he goes away to Rishikesh from Dehradun, right? After he has finished that interview. And he says that he's standing in a cliff all alone, and he's just looking down, very, very disturbed. He doesn't know what he's going to do with his life. Because, you know, some of these things, we might wonder, why not try next year or next time? The conditions in some of these Indian families are very, very different, right? You have to start making progress in your career as soon as you finish your studies. There are other constraints. So this could probably in many, because of all those scenarios, this might be the only opportunity that he had, and it just went away from under his nose, right? And then he explains, he writes about this life-changing experience that he has at this point in his life in his autobiographical book. I think the book Wings of Fire, he writes about it. And when he's standing in Rishikesh, you know, with all these depressing thoughts, he meets Swami Shivananda. Swami Shivananda, again, the Swamiji of the Divine Life Society, Swami Shivananda is again a saint whom Swami has met. Swami has visited his ashram. I think it must have been around the same time. This particular incident in Abdul Kalam's life happens in the late 1950s. Right, and I think Swami also visited Swami Shivananda in the 50s, that apart. So Swami Shivananda comes to him and he asks him, why are you looking so dull and what has happened? And after he hears the whole account of Abdul Kalam, he tells him, see, this is something that you have placed your mind on, but it has not been given to you, which only means that your destiny is different. And your destiny will certainly reveal itself to you. Just accept this moment as God's plan for you, and you will see what changes come, right? And he gives a very, very vague hint that you have a destiny which is much, much larger than you can even imagine, right? So don't worry about this. Just accept this as God's plan. You have wanted it, but God has not given you this. Just keep that in your mind, he says, right? And he says, I mean, as I said, he attends the other interview before that. He clears that interview. Then he joins the Ministry of Defense as one of the senior scientific fellows or whatever was that position. Imagine he wanted to become a fighter pilot. A fighter pilot is one of the important officers in the Air Force, and the Air Force is one of the wings of your Defense Force. Eventually, he grows so much, he becomes the scientific advisor to the Prime Minister of India in matters of defense, right? Imagine he wanted to be one fighter pilot, right? And now what has he become? He becomes the scientific advisor to the Prime Minister of India. And eventually, as I just mentioned, he becomes the President of India itself. And who is the President of India? The President of India is the supreme commander of not only the Air Force, but of all the defense forces. He wanted to be one member of the Air Force. He ends up being the supreme commander of all the three defense forces, right? And all of this started off with a moment of disappointment, where he very, very badly wanted something, but he could not get it. This great success story starts with a disappointment, if you look at it that way, right? And I feel that is why this is a perfect example of what we are discussing at this point in the Bhagavad Gita. Also because of the aspect of the guru stepping in, which comes in the story, right? From where Abdul Kalam was looking at his life, he could not have seen the destiny which was waiting beyond this disappointment. But somebody like a guru comes and tells him, don't be disappointed because there's something larger in store for you, right? So when we believe that God knows what is best for us and my efforts are purely being rewarded by the Lord, automatically I think we will develop that patience, right? That is the most important quality. And when that quality of patience comes, we will start becoming less attached to the outcomes of our efforts. And a few life experiences like this will automatically give us this attitude of siddhi asiddhayoho samaha. What I want happening and not happening is somehow similar to me in my mind, right? This is just few experiences like this, or even if it does not happen to you, even if you constantly keep reading stories like this, I think it will come to our mind that it doesn't matter. I want this, but if it doesn't happen, also Swami might have something better in my mind, right? So Swami will have a better plan for me. And eventually it will give you what we were talking about as samatvam. And that samatvam, yoga uchyate, is spoken of as yoga. So with that yoga of samatvam, or being established in that yoga, we will take up actions and we will do actions with that samatvam constantly in our mind, right? Then we will follow the instructions, yogastah kuru karmani. Yogastah kuru karmani. That being established in that karma, I think that is why the word yogastah is very, very important. He says, constantly in yoga. It is not being in yoga after the actions have been performed. It is not being in yoga before I start doing my actions. Yogastah, past, present and future. Before I take up the action, when I am performing the action, and after I have completed the action, and probably in between the action and the consequence, all three stages you have to be established in that yoga. So the faith that all that I have to do is to do my task properly, and the Lord, who is the dispenser of the destiny, will ensure that I get my reward. That particular Gita Vahini passage that I read out, Swami says that in that, you know, it is not that you completely give up your hope on the results. You also believe that the Lord, who is the dispenser, is going to give me what I need. He's going to give me what is my right due, right? But imagine if you look at it, when we turn to Swami, we often come with a prayer, we often come with a desire. Even if we don't come with a desire, desires keep propping up, right? Swami, I want this thing in my life, I want to achieve this, you know, I want to get this business deal, Swami, I want my daughter to get married in this certain manner. We all have these kind of, you know, achievements which we want, and in a sense we come to Swami with that. If you look at it, when a guru does not give you what you want, he probably is giving you this opportunity to reach a higher state than when he gives you what you want. A true guru is one who, I don't know if I'm right in phrasing it this way, who is fearless to not give you what you want, right? Because he is in the process giving you something much, much higher. So when you turn to Swami and say, Swami, I very, very badly want this, and if Swami refuses it, But if you have the love to say that the Swami who loves me so much is refusing me this, that will give you a state of mind which is much, much higher than what can be achieved by you getting from the Guru what you have sought, right? That is why the idea of the concept of Guru, the concept of God in this whole thing is very, very essential. So Karma Yoga does not speak of it at this point in time, right? At this point in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna does not bring in the idea of Ishvara or Bhagwan or of the Lord. But it is an unsaid thing that is one of the strongest factors which can give you the patience and which can also give you the acceptance of the adverse of what we want. Right? So we will have this, if you look at it, if I were to summarize that, when we start believing and having faith that Swami is the dispenser of our destiny, we will concentrate on what has to be done, right? So even if in the time frame that we want, if the results don't come, we will know that this is a perfect system and the system is being run by the perfect Lord. I have done my actions and He will give me the thing at the right time, right? So that is one part of it. But when we start believing and having faith that Swami is not simply just like an emperor who is perfect, He loves me, He cares for me, we will have this attitude that Swami knows what is best for me and I will accept even reverses because what He gives is always perfect for me, and this will lead us to the attitude of Samatvam. So the devotional aspect will come later in this whole description, but when that comes, I think we will dwell on it. But if we consider that till now Krishna was referring to the yajnas and the yagas that the Vedas speak about, because if you look at the interpretation which Adi Shankara gives for this particular verse, he continues in that same strain, because till now he's been talking about the Vedas and the karmakanda of the Vedas. So he goes on to say that when you take up any yajna or yaga, when you start performing any worship, Shankara says that don't worry about whether the results will come or not. You worry only about how you do the worship. And he says, when you're talking about how you do the worship, it is not about the technicalities, but it is about the bhavam. So he says, if you're worshipping God, worship Him with love. Don't worry about the results of your worship. They will definitely come because God is perfect in that sense, right? So though it has not been spoken of as explicitly in this point, for all of us, I think this is the most important thing. Without, bringing Swami into the equation makes Karma Yoga so very easy for us. So how do we start this whole practice, as a summary of whatever I've said, is first of all, make choices. I think that's something which we always make, and those choices are always based on our preferences, what we refer to as our likes and dislikes and raga and dvesha. Never mind. But having made a choice, having put our effort, can we introduce this thought in our mind that there is a possibility that what I want may not come, but we tell ourselves it's all right. If this does not come, Swami has something better in line for me, right? That thought introduced into our mind will lead us to Samatvam, because Siddhi and Asiddhi, Siddha and Asiddha, the thing happening and not happening, now starts becoming a little bit closer, not in the worldly sense, but in my mental perception of it happening and not happening, right? And that will lead to Samatvam. And constantly remaining in that Samatvam, Yogastaha, remain in that Samatvam, carry on with your actions and, completely give up the consequences. As Swami said, giving up the consequences only means not being perturbed by the consequences. I thought I'll do the other verse too, that is verse number 50. It is more or less a summary of whatever Krishna has been telling at till this point in the past 4-5 verses, but I think we don't have time for that. We'll take it up next week. We'll probably begin with that verse. So these two verses are very, very important, very critical verses in the topic of Karma Yoga in this particular chapter that we are going through. So I think it was worthwhile to spend so much time on it. So thank you, dear listeners, for being with me and giving me this opportunity to go through this in such detail and share it with all of you. It only helps me assimilate it better, and I only hope that it has been helpful to you too. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. I hope you'll all join me again next week at 7:30 p.m. for the continuation of this triune pilgrimage. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and the Vahini Satsang team, which will be the last segment of today's Thursday Live. I'll meet you all again next week, 7:30 p.m. Jai Sairam.